Welcome to the last function room for the time being, the High Seas with Olive Heffernan. She's an award-winning science and environmental journalist and author of this book, The High Seas. This is a great book about a thing that we just really take for granted, but it is unexplored relative to all the other places we think we know. It's the sea, the ocean, the high seas. It's an essential guide. It's been described as an essential guide to half our blue planet. Two-thirds of the world's oceans lie beyond national borders. It's owned by all nations and no nation simultaneously. I'm just reading from the blurb here. The high seas are home to some of the richest, most biodiverse environments on the planet, but also home to exploitation on a scale that few of us have imagined. And in addition to all of this, Olive tells me about some of her absolutely favourite, crazy, mad, inconceivable animals that you didn't even think were possible, but who have existed all this time. We make all this fuss about finding a new lemur, but the stuff, the animals that's already out there, are under there. They're amazing. They're the way they live and survive. It could inspire changes in technology. That's if we don't make them extinct first. Anyway, here's Olive.
I'm Olive Heffernan, and I'm a science journalist. I've been covering oceans and climate change for the past 20 years, and I'm also the author of a book called The High Seas, Ambition, Power and Greed on the Unclaimed Ocean.
I'm about a quarter of the way through The High Seas, and the first thing that strikes me, and it's almost like I'd encourage anyone to even read the first chunk of it in some format, buy the book and read whatever you want, but it's the sheer scale of the ocean. And I don't know why I didn't think of it before, but how big it is compared to the rest of the space we live in.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that I wrote The High Seas was because I wanted to impart my sense of awe and wonder at the global ocean and everything that it does for us to my readers. And I suppose one aspect of that is just the sheer scale of it, right? So if you think about the open ocean, it is 95% of the living space on Earth. So if you think about our planet, just in purely volumetric terms, you know, most of what we're familiar with, whether it's forests or ice caps or deserts, that's just a tiny sliver of what Earth has to offer. Most of it is open ocean. And the reason it's such a large portion of our planet is because it's so deep. On average, it is 4,000 meters deep. But in parts, it gets much deeper. You know, the deepest part of the ocean is 11 kilometers. That's in the Pacific in the Mariana Trench. So we're just talking about an enormous, enormous space.
I wonder, is it our obsession with maps? Maps are so 2D, and we obviously know, like, the number that's in my head is not 95% volume. It's that oceans are 79% of the area. So it's like the first conceptual leap when it comes to thinking about the oceans is it reminds me a bit of when you were studying maths in school, that moment where you added another axis on. So you get your X's and the Y's, how far up and how far over. And then there came this moment where people started talking about Z's. And for me, that was, in reading your book, the notion of this three-dimensional living space.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we often hear it's half the surface of our planet. That's the high seas, which is the unclaimed ocean that I write about in the book. But, you know, the ocean is 70% of the surface of our planet. I think, you know, most of us interact with that environment in a fairly two-dimensional way. I mean, our, you know, chance of seeing the high seas or the open ocean is usually in an aeroplane, right, when we're taking a transatlantic flight. So very few of us have actually had any opportunity to kind of dive beneath the waves. And we think about it as being fairly, you know, uniform, but it's vastly more complex than the ground that we tread upon. And I wanted to capture some of that complexity in the book, you know, just the amazing life forms and places that are out there that, you know, to be honest, it's only really being mapped now in any real detail. You know, there's a plan to sort of map the entire ocean seabed by 2030, but, you know, we're nowhere near achieving that right now.
What's been your journey to writing this book, just in terms of a brief biog? What took you out on the high seas?
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of been obsessed by the ocean for about as long as I can remember. You know, I started rock pooling when I was a child and started doing these surveys of the coastal waters when I was a teenager and sort of realized they weren't as pristine as I'd imagined. And, you know, rather than that sort of quelling my enthusiasm for wading further in, I think it propelled me and I became a diver and I studied marine biology, became a fisheries scientist. I moved to the UK to become a researcher. But pretty soon into that, I realized that I just really wanted to write about the ocean. So I've been doing that, like writing about the ocean and climate change and our relationship with the planet for the past 20 years. You know, I think the reason I wrote a book about the high seas was because I think it's such a poetic term. You know, most of us have some idea of what it is. We think about it as this wild west of our planet, you know, a frontier where it's out of sight, out of mind, anything goes. And we also think about it as a place of great danger and mystery. So it really intrigued me to realize only in about 2018 that it's actually a legal entity. Like, this is half of our planet that is not owned by anybody. And it's shaping up as a frontier in all sorts of ways. Like, we're kind of at a point where we've used a lot of resources on land, in coastal waters, our population is growing. And we're now looking to this unclaimed half of the planet to see how we could use it or exploit it. And I just thought, that's amazing. You know, it's also interesting because while that's happening, there's also a conversation been happening, like at the UN, about, you know, how we might protect this half of the planet. I just thought, what are the chances that most people know what it is or have any idea that there's a discussion underway about how we might protect it or use it? It's such a big conversation. I wanted people to know about it.
Yeah, it really feels like we are just actually a small element of what effectively is a watery planet. The planet is water. And, you know, talking about the volume and the fact that volume is water, then water compared to air just has so much energy in it. So everything about us, just based on what I've read so far, everything about the planet, the planet's processes depends on the sheer physics of all that water, doesn't it?
It does. So I think, you know, when most of us think about the ocean, if you were to say to someone, oh, what does it do for us? You might think, well, okay, lots of us depend on fish as protein. And, you know, we'd probably think, well, you know, we love coral reefs and those are really beautiful. There's lots of gorgeous things out there. But I suppose, you know, it also just does a lot of stuff for us in terms of regulating the climate. Like, we couldn't survive on this planet, you know, in a sort of happy, comfortable way, as we do now, without the ocean. So I wanted to capture that, you know, just to give you some numbers. I think, you know, it's amazing to think that 90% or more of the heat that we've generated from burning fossil fuels has gone into the ocean. 25% of the emissions that we've released into the atmosphere, those, you know, CO2 polluting gases, have gone into the ocean. You know, it produces half of the oxygen available on Earth. And that goes back into the ocean. It's not actually the oxygen that we breathe. But, you know, if you just think about some of those numbers, it's interesting because when you think about the ocean versus the atmosphere, like, the ocean has enormous heat capacity. It can basically, I think it has like 4 times the heat capacity of the atmosphere, and it's much denser. So, you know, seawater is kind of about like maybe 800 to 1,000 times denser than air. So when you think about all of that, just the incredible capacity that it has, it's got a much bigger mass, it's got a much bigger heat absorption than the atmosphere. And that's just doing an incredible service to us, you know. And what we're seeing is there's a massive acceleration of heat entering the ocean now. But, you know, it can only continue to do that if it's healthy, if it's, you know, not polluted, if it's pristine, you know. So looking at some of those numbers is just really fascinating. Yeah. I've been trying to get a handle on that, actually. And that's one of the things that I've explored in the book and since writing the book.
Yeah, it really feels like we're living on top of a machine or next to an enormous machine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you saw, but just yesterday, actually, a group of scientists wrote an open letter to the Nordic states warning that this conveyor belt, you know, that transmits heat and salt around our planet part of that, which is happening in the Atlantic Ocean. It's called AMOC. It's the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. And part of that is the Gulf Stream. So there's evidence that that's slowing. So when you think about the ocean and how it works and how heat interacts with it, like when heat enters the ocean, it doesn't just change the conditions for marine life. It also changes the ocean physically. So basically, if you've got cold, salty water, that is denser than warm, fresh water, and that sinks. And that sinking is what drives this circulation. So once that starts to kind of be interfered with, then we've got a problem. And then that whole system starts to slow.
And is there a problem that we might have a guess at what the results are, but actually, given the complexity, we don't even know how that might manifest?
Absolutely.
If you mess with the machine, like it's like one of these chaotic outcomes that we can't predict.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was one climate scientist, you know, decades ago, he said it's like an angry beast and we're poking it. You know, we don't really know exactly what the outcomes are. Like there are projections of what might happen. But, you know, it's a complex system and all of it interacts. So, you know, it's tricky. But, you know, I was trying to get a handle on those numbers of the heat that's entering the ocean. So if we think about it in sort of, you know, maths terms, there's, I think, since 1955, 360 zettajoules of energy has entered the ocean as heat. And I was thinking, well, what's a zettajoule? I have no idea what a zettajoule is. So scientists have tried to unpack this a bit, and they say, okay, if you think about an atomic bomb, there are 10 zettajoules of energy in an atomic bomb. And they say that basically 7 to 8 atomic bombs worth of energy are entering the ocean every second of every day for the past several years. So over the past several years, it's been basically 10 zettajoules. But I was thinking, well, you know, I don't really have a concept in my head of what an atomic bomb's worth of energy is. So I spoke to a few other scientists, and there was one scientist, a guy called Jan Zika at the University of New South Wales in Australia. And he explained it like this. So if you think about all of the energy production on Earth, so in terms of coal-fired power plants, solar, hydrothermal, everything, in terms of our energy production, that's 0.1 of a zettajoule of energy. So if you multiplied that by 100, right, and you used it to generate electricity, and then you used that electricity to, say, you know, heat some sort of a heater, you know, you generated heat from it and you dumped that in the ocean. That's what we're doing every year. Yeah. But of course, you know, the ocean is enormous, right? So I'm trying to get a handle on what does that actually mean. It's interesting. Like if you think about it, there's, I think, 1 kilojoule of energy is required to heat 1 kilo of water by 1 degree Celsius.
Yeah.
But there's trillions of buckets of water in the ocean. So it's quite interesting conceptually to just think how much heat we're putting in and how much of that is warming and what would happen if that wasn't still taking place. You know, if all of that heat entered the atmosphere,
we're kind of at the early stages of measuring this. It seems weird to say, but measuring the size of the ocean properly for the first time and thinking of it because we've kind of gone into space or been obsessed with space but haven't realized just how much space there is. I mean, it used to be described as inner space, wasn't it? The time when the ocean was called that, but I hadn't heard that term in a while, and I wonder, almost in exploration terms, without the negative connotations of exploration, that if we start thinking about it as being voyaging to inner space again to bring back that wonder and necessity and drive to do so, to capture the imagination, maybe that's what gets us going.
I mean, it's really fascinating to think, actually, just our period of exploration of the deep ocean, even just any depths of the ocean, has been pretty short-lived. Like, it really started about 150 years ago with the Challenger expedition, which was this expedition that left the UK in the early 1870s, and it was the first voyage really that had scientific inquiry at its as its primary purpose, right? So they basically sampled every ocean basin in the world, and they used these kind of, you know, weighted ropes to actually measure the depth of the ocean, like really rudimentary science. But, you know, this is only 150 years ago. And at the time, they actually believed, like a good number of scientists believed, that there was no life beyond 500 meters. It was called the Azoic, devoid of life. And that's incredible to think that in the last 150 years, you know, we've just learned so much, but still so much to learn. You know, even now in the last 5 years, you know, scientists who are looking at the Pacific Ocean, they're finding that 90% of what they bring up has never been seen before by anyone on Earth. It's entirely new to science.
And there's so much fuss when you see a new lemur in the forest, you know, it makes the headlines.
Yeah.
But by and large, in terms of animals, we've sort of found them all. We still have to explore the soil properly, but in the ocean, you mentioned some species I didn't even know about them. What are your favorite species that have been recently discovered, or things that the world should know a lot about?
I think people should know about the scalyfoot snail. This is a really cool creature. It's been found at three locations in the deep sea, all at hydrothermal vents. So a hydrothermal vent it's like an underwater geyser in a way. So hot water is boiling up through the surface, and, you know, it sort of leaches out these minerals and metals, and they're extreme environments. So the scalyfoot snail has been discovered from that environment. And what's fascinating about it is that its shell is made from iron sulfide, but its soft, fleshy foot also has all of these little iron plates on it. And what scientists discovered in, I think, 2020 was that it's actually a microbe that lives in symbiosis with the snail that makes the iron plates for it. And, you know, it gives it nutrition, so it's a nice relationship. And other scientists then have decoded the genome of the microbe because they think that it might have some use in, you know, developing better human armor. So I think that's really interesting. And what's also interesting
this is a snail basically living on top of an underwater kettle, and it's got a bacteria that's welding its skin for it.
Absolutely cool. Isn't it just amazing? Yeah. It's just gorgeous. I also love the gummy squid.
And sorry, I interrupt you on that. You what are they thinking for this scalyfoot snail?
Well, they think it could lead to better application, you know, sort of all these applications. Maybe it could enable us to make better armor for humans. But the places where it lives have also been earmarked for deep sea mining. So there's a bit of a conflict there. You know, do we allow that to happen, or do we sort of, you know, keep the snail safe for other applications? So that's interesting. There's also the gummy squirrel, which is cool. That looks like a cross.
A gummy squirrel.
Yeah, a gummy squirrel. In fact, it was an Irish scientist who works at the Natural History Museum in London who came up with that name.
Yeah.
And it's
sounds like an anime character or a Pokemon.
It has the colors of a Pokemon. It's beautiful. It's sort of yellow and a bit like a cross between a shoe and a banana. And it sort of lives at 5 kilometers below the surface of the ocean, deep in the Pacific, and it sort of crawls its way along. It just looks amazing. It's like, you know, it's like some alien life form.
And does, apart from just looking amazing, or is that all the gummy squirrel does, or does it doesn't have a microbe welding its skin for it yet?
Not that I know of, but maybe they'd find out, you know, if they did the research.
I guess when you look like a Pokemon, then you don't need to make as much effort on other aspects of it. And then there's some of the organism described, the sheer size of them, or just the alien concept of what it means to be alive, what we think of as being an organ, you know, a fish or an alive thing in the sea is baffling. Any other favorites among that?
I really like the siphonophore. So that's basically the longest creature on Earth that is known. I think they found one that was like 120 meters long or something in Australia. But it's really a colony of organisms that are all strung together like a beautiful necklace. And actually, it's cool because it has these long tentacles that could sting you. So, you know, you probably wouldn't want to get too close to a siphonophore.
So but a jellyfish, a bit like a jellyfish, but the length of Croke Park GAA stadium, or a football stadium and a half, a football pitch and a half. The spelling is siphonophore. Does it siphon things? Is that what the name comes from?
Yeah, it's like a sort of, you know, does it siphon things? I mean, I think it sort of wraps things up in its tentacles and then it sort of slowly digests them, I imagine. Yeah.
What a way to go.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't want to be stuck in a bath with a siphonophore.
But all of these things occur in parts of the ocean that we don't know a lot about and yet are hugely important. You mentioned the area called the twilight zone of the ocean in the book. Can you tell me about the twilight zone?
Yeah, so the siphonophore lives in the twilight zone, and that's a sort of a gloomy midwater lair. So, you know, most of us are familiar with the sunlit waters, and they basically, you know, they're kind of the top, maybe 100 meters of the ocean is fairly sunlit. But beyond that, you're getting into this gloomy lair where it's not as dark as, say, the midnight zone, which is very dark and, you know, deep in the ocean. It's where light is starting to peter out. And we're talking sort of between 100 meters and 1,000 meters depth. And it's just such an incredible place. I mean, 150 years ago, scientists thought nothing lived there, that it was like an oceanic desert. But like in recent years, scientists have basically said they think it holds the largest untapped fishery on Earth. And the creatures that live there, a lot of them are tiny, like a quarter of the size of a sardine. But, you know, if you magnified them, they would look like monsters. Many of them have, you know, just these huge, you know, teeth that hardly fit inside their jaws. They have, you know, barbels to attract prey. There's a lot of bioluminescence. It's a kind of a weird, wonderful realm of the ocean. And what's really interesting is that a lot of the marine life in the twilight zone, it migrates from the depths. So during the day, a lot of these creatures, they hide in the depths of the twilight zone. But at night, they come up to the sea surface to feed on, you know, sort of plankton and algae, and then they migrate back down. And in doing that, they're actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere and bringing it down to the deep sea. And this is actually the largest animal migration on Earth. It happens every single day. It involves thousands of species and trillions of individual organisms.
And it's vertical. It's up
and down. It's vertical. And it is just so incredibly cool. So essentially what they're doing is, you know, they're going up to the sea surface to feed. And then, you know, when they come back down, they're either, you know, taking whatever life form it is, whether it's, you know, plankton or, you know, seaweed or even small zooplankton, that's all carbon, right? So once they bring it back down to the deep sea, either they're going to die or be eaten or they're going to excrete, and that carbon basically stays down there. So that's doing a huge service to us, because otherwise that carbon would be in the atmosphere warming the planet.
And there's a lot of wishful thinking and tech solutions, a lot of guff and hot air talked about carbon capture on land and the overtly technical solution and this kind of idea that humans can do what they want as long as they clean up using cool ways, capturing carbon and all that kind of thing. And yet while all of that talk is going on, these humble, amazing creatures are actually doing all of that vertically, trafficking shite, basically, aren't they? They're moving poo up and down the water, and it falls to the bottom, and that's carbon on the bottom that we hope will never be disturbed. It's humbling to think of it, really, isn't it?
It is humbling to think of it. And I think, you know, our tendency is just to think, well, how can we do more of that? How can we get them to do more of that for us, rather than thinking, how can we stop polluting? But, you know, there's lots of ideas floating around as to how we could get more carbon into the ocean. And of course, you know, it's not without consequence. I think it's probably a good idea in the short term to think about how can we get carbon down to the deep sea? Because, you know, if it gets beyond 500 meters, it's going to stay there for, you know, maybe hundreds of years. But below 1,000 meters, it can stay there for longer, maybe thousands of years. So the idea is it would buy us some time to kind of sort our stuff out, right? Like we get our act together while they're doing this. But yeah, lots of ideas for how we could stuff more carbon into the ocean.
But paradoxically, of course, we're aware of it. And yet our urge is not to even just leave them be, do their carbon storage thing in the ocean, but to fish the ocean and disturb the very system that is actually saving our bacon, because we still haven't conceptualized it. You know, we think about forests and sucking in carbon. We've kind of had an idea of that. We're getting there with peatlands, but we're still not there with understanding what the ocean does from a carbon capture point of view.
Exactly. I mean, there's scientists who are really trying to put hard numbers on this, because I guess that's what maybe wakes people up to it. Like, you know, they figured out that this kind of relay of carbon capture from the surface that goes, you know, down to depth with all these animals involved, you know, that's taking an equivalent, maybe it's equivalent to something like the annual emissions from the US. So it's, you know, it's significant. And there's another channel called marine snow, which is literally just detritus. I think it's the most euphemistic term that I've come across, you know, marine snow. It sounds like this beautiful blizzard in the ocean, but it is just things like fish poo and scales of fish and, you know, sort of bits of maybe plankton that have died, and they're all falling down and they get gobbled. You know, they get gobbled at various layers of the ocean. A lot of it gets eaten in the twilight zone. So it's only about 10% of this makes it beyond the twilight zone. But yes, our scientists are trying to put a hard number on this and saying it's huge. It's really important. Sizable carbon capture. But then on the other hand, there's nations such as Norway who are really interested in fishing this layer of the ocean. And the idea is, you know, I said that they're small, these fish. They're only a quarter of the size of a sardine. So it's unlikely that we're going to eat them ourselves. But what we could do is process them into fish meal and, you know, feed that to salmon and expand salmon aquaculture. And that would feed more of the world, you know, but there's a huge trade-off there, right? Yeah. You know, you could have far more salmon aquaculture, but at the expense of this massive service that's being provided to us by all these tiny creatures.
And salmon aquaculture is a more benign term than cutting down forests to grow soy or whatever. Like it, we still don't get it really from a systems thinking point of view, just how all these things have a knock-on effect. By the way, I think marine snow in the twilight zone, if you could get that as a band or album title, that might raise awareness, because it's such an evocative set of words together. In terms of the just something in, are you looking into one of the things I've noticed recently, a lot of talk about seagoing vessels taking sulfur out of their fuel. And then in the oceans, the scale of that has meant that that's been masking climate change for a while. That can you tell the listeners just a little bit about that? Because that's one of these weird things, which was like, we're taking some poison out of the ocean, but it's going to make other things worse. I find it hard to get my head around it.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate, that trade-off, really. So, you know, the International Maritime Organization is like an agency that oversees shipping, and it puts in rules in terms of pollution. So they brought in a new rule a couple of years ago that basically said ocean-going vessels should reduce their sulfur emissions. And the thing about sulfur, like sulfur dioxide, when it's in the atmosphere, it basically masks warming, okay? So it deflects sunlight, and you know, it's bad because it causes pollution. It's really bad for human health, for people's lungs and breathing. And that was the idea, you know, behind the regulations. But yeah, it was masking warming. So now that those emissions have been hugely reduced, what we're seeing is an uptake of heat into the ocean. So basically, global heat uptake, you know, in the ocean, it's accelerated hugely in the last couple of years. In particular, we've just seen a big warming of the ocean, and there's loads of things that are feeding into that. One of them is the shipping regulations. There's other things, like there was an El Nino that happened a couple of years ago, and that's a natural phenomenon where the Pacific Ocean starts to warm, and it kind of nudges the rest of the world to warm, basically. So we kind of see knock-on effects everywhere, more warming. And also, of course, there's just the continuation of our own emissions. But like, all of these things are piling on, and yeah, it's having an impact. So people are worried about that. You know, it feeds into this whole idea that we might end up changing ocean circulation, but also just the stuff we're seeing right now, like all of the kind of severe storms and hurricanes and severe weather. So Yes. I mean, I don't think we can think of this regulation as a bad thing. It's just maybe a reminder of how much we need to clean our act up. But yeah, it's an unfortunate thing, right, that this would happen.
And the need for us to think in terms of systems and not just and how things interact. It's just a reminder of the complexity of everything. Based on your work, you must see where the ocean is resilient and obviously gets damaged. Is it a mixture of optimism and terror? Because if it goes wrong, we're absolutely screwed. But also the ocean has huge reboundability, or it can fix itself if left alone. Do you go through life knowing what you know, oscillating between terror and hope?
I do. I try to kind of navigate it with informed optimism. You know, I think blind optimism annoys me. You know, that sort of denial of where we're at. I find that quite frustrating. But at the same time, you can't just fall into despair either, right? Because that's just useless. It's not, you know, it's not going to help you or anyone. So I think looking at, you know, the evidence of where things have worked and thinking about that is really useful. And yeah, you mentioned the ocean's ability to rebound. Absolutely. Like, I think there's tons of evidence that when we leave nature alone, that it has just this incredible resilience and can rebound. Like, you know, marine protected areas are a really good example of that. There's a place called Cabo Pulmo, which is it's basically off the coast of California, somewhere between California and Mexico. And that was set up as a marine reserve. And, you know, after they kind of excluded fishing from the area, you know, I think marine life, it rebounded by something like 460%. And then they were able to go back and fish it sustainably. You know, they were able to maybe implement measures that, you know, allowed the economy to continue. They attracted tourism, but, you know, they weren't just kind of decimating it to hell. So I think there's loads of evidence that that's possible. There's loads of spillover effects from marine reserves. Like, you know, I think you don't necessarily need to change the overall level of fishing, but that's another conversation. We probably do need to change the overall level of fishing, but, you know, there's lots of evidence that if you just set up marine parks, that you can actually restore nature. And I think it's interesting to look at the statistics. Like, even if you're talking about carbon, I think marine life in the ocean, like, there's one paper that says if you think about everything from whales down to microbes, that's about 1.4 billion tons of carbon. And if we just restored 8 species of whale, that would add another, like, I think something like 8.7 million tons of carbon to the ocean. So, you know, instead of doing something maybe crazy and experimental, like, I don't know, adding crushed rock to the ocean or loads of iron sulfate, which has been an idea, maybe we could just restore some of what's been lost, and that would have the same effect without the negative consequences. So, you know, I'm definitely optimistic, but I like to be informed about my optimism.
Yeah, it seems key to something like that is for us to adopt a certain humility when it comes to nature and its ability to handle complexity, because we still engineer things, don't we? Like, our mathematics is still, you know, I'm going to do X, I'm going to convert this amount of volume of this into this, and that should produce, you know, it's kind of, you know, there's relatively simple equations that we do, but the huge system of an ocean has a complexity we can't appreciate and therefore can recover at ways we can't even predict.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're spot on when you say about we need systems thinking. Like, everything's so siloed, just the way we've set everything up. You know, when you think about how decisions are made at a policy level, there's all these different departments, you know, that are kind of making their own decisions. And we're at a point in time when a lot of the problems that we're facing environmentally, they transcend jurisdictional boundaries and all of these little silos in policy. Like, that's what we're facing, whether it's pollution or climate change or any of those things. I don't know how to suggest getting around that. Like, I think that is one of the things that I've really taken away from reporting the book, that, you know, it seems crazy that we would think about fishing the ocean's twilight zone, But, you know, from the perspective of maybe an economy like Norway, they're trying to wean themselves off fossil fuels, or at least they're looking down the track of what's coming. And they know that they're not going to keep making money out of that long term. So they need to diversify. It's very rational for them to decide to go and fish the Twilight Zone. But from a global perspective, that's not going to do us any favors. What do you do with that? There's all these rational actors with their own self-interest.
I guess we need to capture the imagination with lots of,
siphonophores. We need to have a big look in, don't we?
There a Yeti crab as well, too? Do we need to get people thinking about the Yeti crab?
Yeah, that's another creature from the hydrothermal vent world. And it's just so incredible. It's got these big, like really long, hairy claws. And what's really cool is that, you know, algae basically grow on the hairs and then it feeds off the algae. So it's basically got like its whole sort of lunch and dinner on its arms. It's very self-sufficient. It's just so gorgeous. So cool.
Where's your favorite place you've been and where would you like to go? All things being equal and with no technical limitations.
I think the best place maybe I was for the book, I think, was Elephant Island in Antarctica. So that was really an amazing experience. It's one of these places that has become a political flashpoint just in terms of that sort of tension between conservationists and, you know, harvesters of marine resources. But, you know, what's very cool about Elephant Island is that it's where Shackleton's crew were marooned when they lost endurance to the sea ice. So it was a real privilege to get to camp there and to hang out with these incredible biologists who were doing the first global survey of chinstrap penguins. And they're kind of a bellwether for how this part of the world is doing generally. So that was really interesting. It was just one of those places that was hard to leave. Yeah, felt very, very remote. But in terms of where I'd like to go, oh God, I mean, there's just so many incredible places on the high seas. Where would I love to go? I'd love to see the Emperor Seamounts in the Pacific Ocean. You know, that's like an underwater mountain chain of extinct volcanoes. It would be cool to see them. 9 of them have been named after Japanese emperors because they're so majestic. I'd love to go to the Sal de Maya banks in the Indian Ocean. It's like one of the world's largest seagrass meadows in very shallow waters, but in the heart of the Indian Ocean. And you've got all of these cool things like pygmy whales and just incredible sea creatures there.
But even hearing you say the phrase, what did you say? Sea meadows, was it? Like, you
seagrass
know,
it's meadows. Yeah.
I think that seagrass meadows, I think it helps us think of the ocean differently when you describe words like meadows to it. How big are those meadows, do you know, off the top of your head?
I think it's like 40,000 square kilometers.
Wow.
Yeah.
So a field the size of Ireland.
Just incredible.
Nearly, or half the size
like
of Ireland.
Really important for capturing all that carbon. And yeah, I'd say it's really beautiful. It would be nice to see that. Yeah. Lots of special places out there.
Those are places you might go. What are you up to next? Is it all leading to a plan to visit the seagrass meadows and the chain of mountains along the Pacific, or are you headed in a different direction?
No, I would like to do that. But I suppose the last year I've been very focused on ocean conservation in Ireland, actually. So I've been looking at a place called Loch Inne Marine Reserve in County Cork. And that is one of the most important marine sites in the world. It is a marine sanctuary, one of those places that is intended to protect marine life. And I got some funding from a US organization called the Pulitzer Center to explore the depths of Loch Inne and to see how it's faring. But it's an incredible place.
And not a bad place to make. To make land either. Just after Loch Inne, you're in West Cork. So you have the best of inner space and our space as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's such an incredible place. So it's nice to be back on home turf as well, actually, and to sort of think about this wider story in the context of what's going on here. I've really enjoyed that. You know, I think that's been illuminating. So yeah, but maybe I'll head back out to sea soon. That would be nice too.
Okay. Olive Heffernan, thank you so much for coming into the Function Room.
Oh, thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
That was Olive Heffernan, my final guest for the time being on the Function Room. I hope to bring it back. It needs more time. a better producer, someone who isn't me, and a co-presenter, probably, someone who isn't me. But I haven't given up, because mathematics for me is an unlikely gateway to a richer world, meeting smart, interesting people, and giving me, and I hope you, that brain tingle where you just get a glimpse of the tiny bit of the unknowable, and you get some new insight. And if nothing else, you have something fascinating to tell somebody while leaning at the bar at the next wedding you're at. So my huge thanks to the more than 50 guests who were so generous with their time, who answered an email out of the blue from an unknown podcaster on an unknown podcast, and then served up hours of knowledge, insight, and wisdom. So that's it from the Function Room. You can find the Few Scoops podcast with Aoife Moore once a week on the Go Loud Network or wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, from me in the Function Room, just locking the door of it and making sure that it's been hoovered, goodbye.